All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming to this talk. This is an interesting talk by Monal. He's working in Netflix as part of the CDE team that builds a bunch of cloud database and storage systems as service. And he's talking today about declarative benchmarking of Cassandra and its data models. So thank you.
Thank you, guys. So we don't have a mic. If you're not able to hear, don't hesitate to shout out, and I'll raise my voice. So don't worry about interrupting, but let me know. I'd rather have you guys interrupt than not be able to hear. I'll try my best to speak as loudly as I can. Okay, cool. So I'm Monal Dakshini. I've worked at Netflix for about 8 years on several data stores. I also built their petabyte scale streaming pipeline and introduced Apache Flink and Kafka to Netflix. So today, we'll start at why this project actually even started. So with Netflix's large footprint of Cassandra clusters, we have lots of applications and very unique data models, and there are lots of them. And so it becomes very difficult to evolve them or create new ones and make sure that they're scalable, right? So developing and evolving these schemas over time, considering we also have to move versions of Cassandra, it takes a lot of iterations in application code, in schema, in Cassandra configuration changes to find the right balance to achieve the scale and functionality that's necessary for these applications. That kind of motivated the creation of this tool. And so today what we'll do is we'll look at the challenges in building something without this tool, right? How is it to build schemas, test them for scale, and then being able to validate what you were expecting out of it? How would you do it traditionally? How would we do it with the tool? And then we'll look inside the underneath the hood of the tool and see what's the philosophy of the tool, how it works, and how some of the techniques it uses can be applied across different data stores. And so let's just dive directly in. Traditionally, when you want to do something like this and you're starting out from scratch, there's a bunch of steps that you might take. So you'd first go ahead and design your data model and the schema for your application. Then you design the application queries for it, and they go kind of hand in hand. You may iterate over it because it's Cassandra, so you need to know your access patterns, and then you kind of go back and forth between the data model and schema. And then you identify, okay, what's my application load going to look like? And for example, if you have two queries, two APIs in your application, each API might end up making multiple query calls to Cassandra, or it might be one query call, right? So we need to figure that out. And then we need to figure out before we generate load on the application to figure out scale. Like each API has been invoked how many number of times? You know, is one invoked 100 times, the other 200 times? So we need some kind of estimates to figure out what we want to scale the application to and then test it accordingly. But then you have to prepare your test data, right? And then once you have your test data, now your queries are maybe prepared statements or have query parameters, right? So you need to worry about where do I fetch all these query parameters from? If I have existing data set and I've created this test data, now I have to worry about getting these parameter values, using them while I'm actually running the queries, but not impacting the actual performance test, right? So that's another thing you have to worry about. Then you have to actually code an app to execute these queries so that you can drive the load on the application. And then you have to instrument and capture metrics and dashboard and analyze the results. And then you also have to make sure that the load generation follows what the application load estimates are in the real world. So after that, you kind of end up analyzing the results and you look at your findings. And if they're not satisfactory, you go back to step one and repeat the whole process again, right? So this is pretty heavy. Imagine in addition to all these steps, we wanted to test these applications on different versions of Cassandra. So you might say, I'm moving to version 3. I want to test the same data model version 2 and see if there are any discrepancies or if there are any bugs in maybe Cassandra, or the way Cassandra works is slightly different, so I might have to tweak things, right? And so this is a lot of steps, a lot of duplicated effort across different application teams that are trying to do this, and it's really cumbersome. So you end up really not sometimes testing it fully at the scale, and then you rely on canarying in production and figuring out bugs eventually there. So what we wanted it to be is very easy, quick, and ergonomic. And as I was mentioning, this actually was born out of a real need for a very critical service at Netflix that was being revved, and we wanted to make sure it truly scales. And I'll walk you through that example and what we actually found. So building this tool, what we want to do is we want to cut down steps 5 to 8, right? That's the main heavy lifting. The rest of the steps are necessary because you have to still design your schema, you have to identify queries and query patterns. And the step 9 is you still have to kind of configure this new tool and run it, right? And we'll look at how easy that is as well. So this tool is actually built as a plugin to an existing benchmarking tool we have called IndieBench. So if you're unfamiliar, this is a quick 1-minute overview of it. So it's kind of a generic benchmarking tool that we built, and it's very pluggable. So we write different plugins for different data stores currently, and we have quite a few plugins available. And this is open source and hosted on GitHub. It also has dynamically tunable requests per second. So it has reads and writes, and you can say I want X number of writes and X number of reads, and it drives the load. And it has some load patterns you can simulate, random or a time window or a Zipf-ian distribution. So at a high-level overview, it looks like this. Basically, we have these sets of nodes here. And these nodes are the ones that have the code for the IndieBench framework and also the plugin that's driving the load. The app UI just controls and drives it, and we'll take a look at that. And then you have your target test cluster with the schema and test data, right? And then you record a bunch of metrics. So at a high level, the architecture is kind of pretty simple. There's a lot going on underneath the hood, but at the high level, this is what's happening. So now we're writing a plugin for this to actually emulate the application query logic, right, against real or generated data. We want to actually specify the traffic percentage distribution. So for example, let's say you have 5 queries that your application is going to run. You can say query 1 runs 12% of the time, query 2 runs 18% of the time, and then you want, when it runs, you want to randomize the execution of queries, but you want them to follow that percentage distribution. Now, eventually, we will look at capturing the real traffic of a certain service that's already live, and if that service wants to move, then we can have that captured distribution and we can replay that. We don't have that yet, but it's something for the future. And this tool also needs to do some basic type coalescing. So let's take a scenario where we have query one, you get, let's say, user information from one of the Cassandra tables. Now we want to run one more query to get some more information from a second table. We don't have joins, so we'll have to run 2 queries. Now in the second query, we want to use the results from the first query, which is usually what happens in applications. And in the second query, the data type might be a string. What you got is an int, so you need to kind of coalesce it. So this tool does some basic coalescing automatically out of the box. And before the tool starts, it has very thorough validation, and it will throw errors if it finds incompatible data types or data types that it cannot coalesce. And we wanted to build this so that it can run any kind of SQL statement, and it supports all data types, right? Before this plugin, we had to write one plugin for every kind of data type you wanted to test or support. So we were still able to do it, but it was a little cumbersome. And we want to support any Cassandra version that supports SQL. So it doesn't matter 2.1, 3, 4, as long as the user provides valid SQL statement, it should work. So what do we actually have used it for, and what do we plan to use it for? So we've used it to, as I was saying, validate a data model at scale. And we've used it to compare the same data model between 2 Cassandra versions. And in the future, we're looking at helping certify some of the Cassandra changes or updates we make. As I was mentioning, we have lots of different unique data models at Netflix, and we want to make sure the changes we pull in or a new version of Cassandra that we put out, we want to make sure it works for all these data models, right? And so we want to curate these data sets, or we just restore them from backups. And then if you have this benchmarking tool with just SQL queries specified, they can just run the queries, and we'll have a lot high confidence that if you put this build out there, it's not going to break applications. And you also want it to use for data generation. So let's say you built your own data schema and it's a brand new application, right? You still have to fill it with some data. You could migrate some data if you had an existing system, but if it's a brand new, you might not have it. So we do some basic data generation today, but we want to add more support in the future. So we'll use it for that as well. So it not only helps you run the queries, but it also helps you see the data with certain patterns and stuff like that. So let's take a walkthrough of what this plugin looks like to user in the end and how much time it takes them to actually set it up. So this is basically steps 1 to 4 and 9 that you looked at and how that materializes into the tool, right? So let's say this is the schema that the user came up with. It's pretty simple. We have a user table. We have a user index. And just like an index. And then we have these two tables on the bottom here, map and set test. Those are just contrived tables here to show the capability of the tool, that it can automatically create dynamic collections when it's writing to these tables. So let's look at this first query, right? And it's pretty straightforward. Here, all it's doing, it's taking a projection and getting two fields out of the user table, right? Where the user ID is a certain value. So for a given partition key, we are extracting user ID and profile ID. Now, we want to use that in the second select statement, which is going into this column family called foreign keys, and where this value that we look at here, that's the profile ID returned from this select query, right? So a combination of these two queries actually ends up servicing a single application API call, right? So that's what I'm calling it, a group. So this is a query group one, and we've identified that it runs 70% of the time. So similarly, there's a slightly more complex query here where in addition to the two fields, we're also getting a third field. But we want to use these three fields in a more complex statement, which is a batch statement, and it's inserting. We have two inserts. There's one here, one here. And we have two more inserts on the bottom here. So one insert is inserting values into a map, and the second one is inserting into a set. So the one thing you'll notice is here, it's creating a map out of scalar values returned by the first query. Right? And the same thing here, it's creating a set out of scalar values returned from this query. So this forms the second query group, which satisfies API 2, the second API of our application. And we've determined that it's going to, estimated that it's going to be executed about 30% of the time. So far we've identified what our schema looks like, what our queries looks like, what the query distribution is for our queries, right? So now how do we configure the tool with this information to run? And before we do that, we're going to slightly tweak these queries, and I'll tell you why. Before I go into that one, I just wanted to show you in place where the plugin's running. So we looked at it before. The new plugin kind of just plugs in here and runs. And this is the schema for how we're going to specify the configuration. So it's very simple. Basically, the top two are going to form the primary key. So there's the ID, which is the group, query group ID, which would be 1 and 2. And then the SQL NUM is interesting because it orders the queries in a certain group. So in an application, when you're running queries for a certain given API, it's always ordered. You execute a certain query, get the results, execute a second query, and get the results back, right? So you want to execute them in order. So this is what lets you execute them in order. And then if you notice at the bottom, there are these columns that start with var, right? The columns here are pretty straightforward. It tells you what consistency level I want to run the query with. And so you can use any kind of consistency level with these queries. So every query could have a different consistency level. And this is the query itself, and this is the percentage distribution. The interesting part here is these three kind of columns specify sources for the variable data, right? So when we looked at the queries, we have to find values for these parameters here, right? And so where do we get those parameters from? And these three columns here kind of give you three options, right? One option is you could get it from a column from another table that's in your database. You could get it from another query that was run by the tool, or you could write your own select statement and say, hey, here's the select statement. This is going to generate the values for me out of the parameter groups. So that's what this is doing here. So with that in mind, now we're going to tweak the original queries so that we can configure it for the tool. Now, all we did was we replaced the question mark with this. Right, so it's a special syntax. Anything between the two question marks is a column that it automatically looks for from the source that you specified. So for example, I could say this query gets its data from the user table. And so what it's going to do is it's going to, behind the scenes, grab the user ID column from that, dump all the data, and then use those as parameter values. So it does that automatically behind the scenes. And we do the same thing here. We are saying, hey, use this profile ID that's returned from a source. Right? And we'll look at a little more detailed picture that brings everything together so it'll make sense. So the same thing here, very similar. We have the user ID thing here. And just as before, instead of question marks, we have replaced it with the actual column that we want to replace the values from a given source. And then you'll notice there's something different, there's something new here. So these are generators, right? So here it's going to, instead of getting the value from any source, it's going to actually generate a timestamp. We can have generators for UIDs, we can have string generators, text generators, time UID generators, we can have different generators to insert values. And here it's the same query, but it's the map, and we're just referencing what that question mark means, right? And this is the syntax for a set, and this syntax for a map. So the query looks very similar, except the question marks are replaced by this small notation that helps us tell the tool where to get the source data from and how to automatically map it. And when we provide this, it's going to do detailed validation to make sure the data types match. So this is where the type coercion is happening. If you go back to our schema that we defined, this profile ID actually that returns from the original query here is a big int, but here it's being used as a string. So there's the type coercion here. Here we are seeing another type coercion, but that value is going into a set now. And then we have another one where we're doing type coercion into a string, but it's now going into a map, right? So you can see how we can dynamically build maps and sets from scalar values from a different query that was run. And so this is just a timer to say how long does it take for a user to enter this configuration and then run the test, right? So let's see how long it takes. So this is the whole configuration for the user that they need to provide. So as we looked at, this was the first query group that has two queries in it. And they also specified, we looked at the percentage, and there's this table here which is saying, get all my parameter values from user table. If you look at the second one, it says, get my parameter values from a query with a ID 1, so it's going to pick this one here, the first one here. So the second group is very similar. The second group has four queries. And if you look here, the consistency levels are different, right? Some of them are running with local quorum. There are some with local one in each quorum, so you can actually tweak the queries. So this gives you a very nice way of emulating what an application would do in the real world. And if you look here as well, it's saying I'm going to get my parameter values from the results of running the first query. Now, this is the third option for sourcing the parameter values. And this is your own select query. You could write your own select query and say whatever this is producing, you might get 10 rows, 200 rows, 300 rows, whatever you get back. Let's assume you get 300 rows back. It's going to start with the first row. First value, use up all the 300 values, and then cycle through it. So that's what it's going to do. So we have three ways of sourcing the data. And only one of them is used. and this is the precedence order. Like we look at the data SQL number first, the table second, and the select third. So in summary, we specified the percentage group, we specified different consistency levels, and if you notice, we specified these columns, but nowhere here we specified what kind of data types we are going to expect here, right? It's all dynamic. So the tool inspects the tables in Cassandra, gets the metadata, and then matches that with what's specified in here and does an extensive checking, right? So your configuration is well behaved. But that also means it becomes very ergonomic to specify things. I don't have to explicitly specify everything. And that also makes it more portable, because if I change my data types and stuff, things would continue to work, and I don't have to change my configuration again. The other nice thing about this is, let's say you have a table that you're sourcing the parameter values from, right? One of the tests we did had, we were projecting one column out of it, and it had 1.2 billion rows, right? So we have to extract this data out onto one of the NDBench nodes, and then we have to cycle through those values so that we can exercise every single value for the query parameter that we had. So it handles that for you. So I have a nice graphic a little bit down the line that kind of walks us through what's happening underneath the hood. But once the user's done configuring the table, the next they go to actually run it. So we use Spinnaker, which is our continuous delivery tool, and it's open source. And it has a functionality called pipelines. Think about it as like a workflow engine, right? And it has a basic UI that you can create to get parameters and stuff like that. So this is basically a pipeline configuration that we are running. And so the first thing we say, okay, this is the name of my NDBench cluster. This is the NDBench nodes that are going to run. And I'm saying, give me three nodes. We could really spin up really large clusters, and we have in the past, up to several hundred nodes if you need to, depending on how much traffic or load we want to generate. And then there's some nice automation around, do we want to automatically delete older clusters? And then this setting here, true, is just an optimization about how the variables are loaded, right? And the rest of it is configuration, where this table that we wrote, which has your query SQL queries, could live on your target cluster, or you could live on a completely different cluster, right? So we need configuration to test where it is. And so there's a bunch of configuration that lets you tweak a lot of things here. So for example, I want to randomize the way I'm going to read my dumped query parameters, right? So we have configuration for that. So once the user just clicks, enters a few fields and runs, they get this nice UI which says, here's your context-specific link to the UI, so it deep links into the cluster created for you. And so what it looks like is, it looks like this. It's a pretty simple UI, which shows that this is the cluster we launched for you to generate the load. This is the plugin that you're currently using, and these are all the machines that we're using. And then the connect driver actually just initializes everything, right? And part of the initialization is grabbing your query parameter values from Cassandra and getting it locally. So next, after that, after it's initialized, you have an option to either start or pause the testing. So the benefit of that is you could start a certain amount of tests, you could pause, you could change your data, make some configuration changes to your Cassandra process, maybe bounce it, and then get it ready for the next run. Right? So it makes the iteration very quick. And it also has some basic statistics that it publishes right in the UI. We have a more extensive dashboard that I'll show you. So in total, it took a user about 30 minutes, right? 25 minutes to kind of enter their SQL test profile, and we're working to make it even faster, and then 5 minutes to use the Spinnaker pipeline to start the test. Right? So compare this to all the 9 steps if you had to do from scratch, it would take really long time. Like, you'd take a couple weeks because you have to write your code, test it, run it, and then keep recycling through it. Here, if you want to change something, you go and change your select statement, and then you have a second test immediately ready to run. So it saves us a significant amount of time to do it. And then we also link to a dashboard that's automatically generated. So here's a dashboard that's generated that shows, you know, what's the read rate, were there any read failures, what are the latencies, and then we have a bunch of other metrics around, system metrics around JVM and CPU and disk and things like that. So this is a dashboard specific to this plugin. And as we can see, we have two groups running here. And let's dig into that graph a little bit. So if you look at it, we know that there's a query one, and it's about 10 milliseconds. And the second group, query group, which had five queries in it total, takes about 105 milliseconds to run, right? And so it gives us a good idea about what to expect from this application on the Cassandra side. And what the other benefit here, what we've done is we've isolated what all the business logic and the slowdowns that the application might be incurring. And here, this is purely what Cassandra would see from a client side, right? So if you're working with the application team and they say, hey, we are seeing huge latencies, is it happening on the server side or is it happening on the app side, right? So this kind of helps set that baseline to know what to expect from Cassandra. So as I was mentioning, we tested this data model that we were developing for this new service, and we were evolving and creating a brand new data model, and we were also moving from Cassandra 2 to Cassandra 3 for them. And our goal was to get several hundred thousand RPS, right? So with this tool, we were able to show that this cluster, Cassandra cluster, is able to do 1.2 million operations per second. And the query profile was very similar to what I showed before, but it had three query groups, right? And it had about 1.2 million parameter rows to be used as parameter values for the queries. So this was a 96-node cluster with mostly read-heavy workload. And so running this, we found bugs in the data model that would have eventually led to very wide rows. And in a few months, we would have to figure out a way to scale it or change the application, right? Because we were able to stress test this and induce this problem much faster, we found it like in 2 days versus a few months that would have happened in production. And then we found slow memory leaks in our client drivers. We found some metric bugs. We found in certain scenarios our prepared statements don't get cached. So we found all these things that we wouldn't have found if we had just canaried the new cluster against the actual traffic, right? So we were able to push this a little bit further than that and do a few more tweaks and iterate really fast to find all of this stuff. So in addition to using it for application, we also, as I was saying, to use it for validating newer versions of Cassandra for the data models we have. So now let's dig deeper and look what's underneath the hood of the tool itself. So just a quick review of what we saw before. These were the three nodes we had launched. The plugin is running here. The plugin code is running in these nodes. And this happens to be the place where we put our configuration. And our data is on the same cluster, right? This configuration could live in a completely different Cassandra cluster. It doesn't have to be on this one. It's just a convenience thing. So this is the non-optimized way where we are not optimizing the loading of query parameters, right? So the user connects, clicks on connect. If you remember the connect button on the UI, when the user clicks on connect, it ends up running a REST call on one of the nodes. That triggers off a initialization. So what happens is it looks at the table, if you remember, the configuration table that we created. It reads that configuration table, parses it, validates all the information, knows what types it needs to coalesce. And then once it does that, it figures out what data it needs to load for the query parameters, right? So in this case, we said, load my parameters, load user ID from the user table. So it's going to go to that table, and it's going to project that user ID and extract all the values, right? Something like all rows reader, and it's going to extract all the values and then store it locally in a SQLite data store on the node. So that when we actually want to use the values, we are not going to Cassandra and fetching it, because that would impact the performance of the cluster, because we are not only sending real traffic that we want to validate, but we are also sending this traffic that's only should be used for testing. So that's why it's important to preload these values externally outside of Cassandra and then actually run the load. So once that happens, we also have an option to specify how many rows, how many values you want to load. So for example, you might have, let's say, 200,000 partitions, right? And you want to only load 10,000 of them. So this loading mechanism has a configuration, and you can say, just load 10,000, I just want to do a quick test. And then it also has an option for randomizing the values. So what I mean by that is, when all this data is loaded from here to here, all the nodes have the exact same data, right? Now, if all of them kind of run through the list in the same order, we don't have a real good randomization. We might have inadvertently benefited from the hot cache on the Cassandra side, where it's caching stuff and the page cache and stuff, which we may not want to do, right? That may not be a desired outcome. So there's an option to randomize. So for example, if you have 0 to 200,000 rows on every node, it'll take a random number between that, and then it'll start from that row, and then it's like a circular buffer, it'll start back up again. So then after that, the third one is when you click the play button, the start button, it issues this rest call, which starts the whole testing, right? So it runs the queries with the parameter values you've given. It makes sure we are running the right amount of distribution and percentage-wise that you're creating. So in those cases, we'll have the first query run 70 times and the second query group run 30 times if you had specified you want a total of 100. So now let's look at the optimized way where we have a very big size of our query parameters, right? We have a huge set of query parameters. Now, how do we optimize this? Because in the previous scenario, every single node goes to Cassandra and downloads that data. Now, that's too much if you have a lot of data, right? So what we ideally want to do is we want to download it on one node and then somehow distribute it across. So that's what this optimization does. It's just a flag. You set the flag and this optimization kicks in. So again, as usual, when you click on the connect, the process starts. It processes the metadata. Now it starts loading the data for the query parameters, sticks it into the local SQLite store. Once that's done, it'll upload that file to S3. And then locally, every node will randomize the start point in that query list. And then when you run init again on all the nodes that didn't have the file will check S3, and they will download that file. So they won't go to Cassandra to download the query parameter files. They just go to S3 and download it, all the nodes. And then we start the load, and then it just runs the load and captures the metrics. Right? So those are the two modes internally how it's actually doing it. And the SQLite store had to be kind of optimized quite a bit for this scenario, so it behaves and runs and operates fast. So it itself doesn't add a lot of latency to the load testing. And so here, this is just another metric, shows how many files were uploaded and downloaded, so we can make sure when things go wrong, what happened. So the another interesting kind of a very small mini innovation in this one was, how do we actually guarantee randomized distribution and the percentage of queries that we need, right? So we might have hundreds of nodes that are driving test queries, but we want to make sure that the percentage of queries that we had specified is honored. And how do we do this in a scalable way and in a lock-free way? Right? So in this scenario, we knew that we have a query group one, which had to be run 70% of the times, and the second one 30% of the times. Right? So we somehow need to make sure it does it. So how do we do it? So we use a small trick. So what we do is we create an array of 100 elements, right? And this happens on every ndbench node. And then we fill it up with values. And in this case, we know that the first query has to be run 70% of the time, so we have 70 ones in it. And then the second query has to run 30% of the times, so we have 32s, right? So we have 70 ones and 32s in an array. And every node in our cluster independently creates this element array, and they're exactly the same, right? Because the percentages are exactly the same everywhere. Now, what we next do is we shuffle this array using Fisher-Yates algorithm. If you're familiar with that algorithm, it's pretty simple. All it does is it generates a random number between 0 and 99 in this case. And whatever, let's say it found the random number to be 4, right? It'll take that and swap it with the last element. And now the thing that it needs to shuffle are only n minus 1. So it's only 99 elements that it needs to shuffle. So it works from the backwards and moves forward. And then in order of n, you have the whole array shuffled. So we only have to do it one time ever for a given run of an application test. So we might run this testing for several days, right? This only happens once during the initialization time. And the next thing we do is each node might have multiple threads that it's using to drive the load, right? And each thread maintains a thread local array index into this array. So the array is not locked. There's no locking mechanism around it. We get away by having individual thread local array indexes, right? And so you have a lock-free way of getting a deterministic percentage distribution across your cluster without any coordination that you need to do. So the next kind of topic we briefly touched upon was data generators, right? So right now we have one data generator. Whenever it sees this, it replaces it by a timestamp. But we are looking at adding more data generators for creating collections and primitive data types and things like that. And as you saw, we can use any kind of SQL statement. So you can use inserts and use these generators to create any kind of test data that you want for your schema. So now if you tie everything back, now you have a mechanism for once you have a schema and once you know your queries, you can also generate a sample test data set if it's a brand new application. And you can have a good feel for what your application could expect from this data model. And so you can iterate over it as fast as you want. And then once you're satisfied, then you can start coding your application. Right? So it saves a lot of time end-to-end when you look at it. So in summary, the declarative benchmarking significantly reduces. We've seen in practice the overhead in being able to develop these scalable data models. It supports all kinds of data types, and you can even do LWT with it in the SQL statements. And then we looked at how we are able to achieve deterministic percentage distribution without any coordination and lock-free mechanism. So for future, I know we said we'll open source it by the time we get here, but we still have some more work to do on it, so we'll open source it soon. We'll add more generators. In the future, we'll look at sharding the amount of query parameter data, right? So right now, every single node loads all the query parameter data, right? So in future, we want to shard that. What if it's so large that it doesn't fit on disk in a SQLite file on that node? We need a way to kind of shard it a little bit better, and that might also give a little bit better simulation of what real world traffic would look like. So we are looking to use the same kind of philosophy and technique in a lot of the code that we've used here to test other kind of data stores. So the next one I'm looking to do is CockroachDB. We're kind of looking at it internally. So that uses Postgres as its client driver. So that means once this tool is built using Postgres client driver, we can not only use it for CockroachDB, but we can also use it to test and validate relational models for Postgres. Right? So there's a lot of value and benefit for us in being able to do this. And this is more of a self-serve model that we are providing to other engineers at Netflix. So if they want to test through certain relational models in the future or Cassandra schema models, they can do it all by themselves, right, up to a certain extent. And then we can help them from the server side if it needs tweaking and tuning. So that frees up a lot of our time rather than having to handle a lot of people. So any questions? For this one? Yeah, it does. Unless you provide any constraints on it, it will load everything. But there's a config parameter in the works where you could tell it that do this, but only load a certain number of rows. Right. So for example, We could take this and run it through an all-rose reader kind of a mechanism where we have a projection, and then we could say, hey, you've already fetched 200 data points, now stop. I don't want you to fetch anymore. So that functionality is not fully integrated right now, but we could apply what we did for the other scenario here as well to kind of limit what's there. But you're right. Right now, currently, in its raw form, it'll read everything out of it. Okay. You guys get... Oh, yeah, one more. So what happens if it's not on S3? Is that what you want me to go over it again?
Is it fetching the file SS tables or
what? Oh, okay. So it's uploading the SQLite file. So this file that was created here, it's uploading the SQLite file. It's not SS tables, is not touching anything on the Cassandra side. This basically is a dump of a projection of certain values from a certain table here. They're dumped in here, and they are put in a certain such a way that they're easy to read from and drive the load. And the other thing this does is, if you see here, this works for any kind of schema that you may have here, right? So this stores the data in very generic form, and it stores what codec was used to read that value from here. So when these values are read back, it uses the same codec to drive the load, right? So the when I say codec, it's the codec that's specified in the DataSex driver to understand how to read the bytes for each column, right? So that's generic. So that's why we are able to use this against any data type, any schema that exists. And then this SQLite file is the one that gets uploaded. And that's the one that gets eventually downloaded as well. So in that whole process, we're not touching Cassandra at all, right? It's completely off isolated. So then when we actually run our query load, the data is just sourced locally. And so we get more true to actual production traffic what Cassandra would behave, rather than having the synthetic traffic of being able to extract parameter values, impacting the dashboards and metrics that we see.
This is probably more a feature of how you restore data into the cluster prior to running the benching. But do you have a way to specify whether to heat the cache or how to heat the cache before you do testing, or you just assume that cache effects are handled elsewhere?
So I think, correct me if I didn't understand your question correctly, but what happens is when we run the workload that actually simulates an application, we don't look at the metrics for a certain period of time until things settle.
All right. So
and then once it settles, then we look at the metrics.
Okay.
So it automatically gets it to that steady state. And then we also know that initially when we do this, what's the impact that you're going to see.
Thank you.
I think there's one more question. Yeah. So in this testing, we tried like i3 4XL. We tried a different size of the cluster. We tried Cassandra 2X and 3X with the same data model. We even tried the same thing running against an older data model. So we just went and changed the SQL queries, and we said pointed to the 2.1 old data model cluster. So now we were able to do like a three-way comparison, like old data model with 2.1 cluster, new data model on 2.1, new data model on 3.1, on 3. And so we were able to get a good picture of across the board. And we were able to do it really fast, right? In a couple of weeks, we were able to do everything end-to-end. The time, because we have to let it run for a period of time to kind of get all the metrics. But otherwise, it would have taken us much longer to kind of prove something like this. And now it's reusable, so anybody can leverage it to do other kinds of testing. Think Yeah, grab me later if you think of any other questions. Otherwise, you get your 5 minutes back. Thank you.